can even trip when I'm sober. Good evening, everybody. My name is Bill Baker, and I'm an alcoholic. It's a pleasure to be here. It's good to see everybody. I used to come here pretty regularly. I've got some kids now, and my life's changed even more. Our life's changed amazingly when we get into Alcoholics Anonymous, provided we take the direction that's offered to us, and my life has definitely changed. My wife and I just had a little girl on January 1st, and her name's Isabella, and she's beautiful, and she's like the new joy of my life, and my son, who's a little bit over 2.5, is the other joy of my life, and I, don't get me wrong, because I love my wife, I truly adore her, but the level of love that I feel for my wife, she knows this, and she's fortunately she's cool with it because she feels the same way. It's nowhere. It doesn't even border on the level of love that I feel for my children, and you know it really helped me to see maybe get a glimpse of how much God actually loves us, is because you know I couldn't comprehend that I could love something as much as I love my son before he was born. And before I got sober, I didn't have any understanding of how much God loves us, how much He loves all of us. And I still don't think I truly understand what the level of that love is, but I can comprehend in a better way because it's like, you remember, you know, in The Grinch, when his heart grows 3 sizes in an instant or whatever it is? That's what happened when my son was born. It was just like, boom, you know, this big, something was released from inside of me, and I know that was God. And you know, we both worried about it when she was pregnant with our daughter. It's like, are we going to be able to love our daughter as much as we love our son? And well, yeah, because God was there, ready to step up and ready to just grace us with this inordinate amount of love, like you know, similarly to the way He loves us. So, fortunately, I did say that I'm an alcoholic, so you know, I'm not just going to talk to you about my kids all night. Do I have to say that I've digressed? But anyway, I do like my kids. I have a sponsor. I sponsor others. You know, all that kind of stuff. I do have a sobriety date. Actually, I probably have a whole bunch of them, but one of them special because it took. I've been sober since September 23rd, 2004. You know, I had a pretty normal childhood. I'm the youngest of 3 children. My parents are still together. My older brother and sister are, you know, maybe a little abusive, but they were just older brothers and sisters, you know. That's part of being the youngest, is you get picked on and, you know, all sorts of weirdness. But, you know, no major trauma in my life. I can't blame my alcoholism on anything other than the fact that I was born. Something was different about me when I was born. I don't know that I was alcoholic from the moment I was born, but I was definitely born with some type of spiritual malady, you know, because I always felt different. I always felt like something was lacking in my life. You know, I was always searching for something else. And, you know, alcohol wasn't even that important to me when I first started drinking, which was when I was 10 years old. I actually just walked into the garage and saw my brother out there stealing some of my dad's warm Budweisers. And I think he had a panicked look on his face, and he was, I've always assumed that his thought process was something like, crap, if I don't bring him, he's going to go tell mom. If I bring him, maybe he won't tell mom. So he says, grab a couple and come with me. So that's what I did. I grabbed a couple, and we ran up behind the woods of the elementary school, and a couple of his friends met us there, and we all sat there and drank warm Budweiser. And I really don't remember having any significant effect from the alcohol that day, but I do remember that for the first time in my life, I felt like I belonged to something that was bigger than me. You know, I felt like I fit in the world for the first time in my life. I always associated that with just the camaraderie of doing bad things, you know. And I don't know whether that's what it was or not. You know, I'm not all into, you know, over-analysis of my childhood or anything like that. But so anyway, I guess because of that, I started hanging out with the kids that weren't doing the good stuff, you know, because it was more fun to hang out with the bad kids than it was to hang out with the good kids. And it made me feel like I belonged. So, you know, it was no short time. I was like 15 years old, and, you know, I'd done a whole slew of things already. You know, I found the Grateful Dead. That became the most important thing in my life. And I followed them for like the next 7 years and you know, in everything that that entails. So my parents were kind of restrictive. They didn't really think it was appropriate that I follow the Grateful Dead while I was still in high school. They thought it was more important that I stay in school and, you know, take algebra tests and boring stuff like that. So I didn't really get to start that in full force until I graduated and I went to college. And I ended up going to college in a small town in Alabama. And quickly realized that college was getting in the way because it was really hard to go see the Grateful Dead and maintain a GPA in college. So I just dropped college. I figured, you know, Jerry Garcia is only going to be alive so long. College is going to be here forever, you know. And I think I actually said something like that to my mother. She didn't appreciate it at the time. She probably wouldn't appreciate it if I told it to her today. But so anyway, you know, that's just what I did. I ran to find what was making me feel good. And that was my life. And that was probably my life a lot earlier than that. And, you know, I didn't get in very much trouble, surprisingly, doing the things that I was doing. But when I was about, I don't even know how old I was, to be honest with you, 23 maybe, I got in some trouble in California. And it was kind of, I had something mailed to me that a particular plant mailed to me, and apparently California thought they had plenty of this plant, and the fact that I used the United States Postal Service made it a federal offense. Note to anybody thinking about mailing stuff: don't use the United States Postal Service. So suddenly, you know, I'm in a lot of trouble, and I have this estranged relationship with my father because my father's real big on education. And I had dropped out of school, and he didn't even know what I had become. You know, and I understand that better today because, you know, as a father, I can see it in my son. You know, I replay a lot of the scenarios that I went through as a child, the way I hurt my parents, and I never understood why they reacted so crazily to it, and I understand that better to now. The measure of the amends that I owe these people is inordinate. But so anyway, you know, I haven't spoken to my father really for a few years except for niceties at family gatherings and whatnot. And so I call him and I'm like, you know, Dad, I'm in a lot of trouble. You know, they're talking about like $30,000 bail, yada, yada, yada. He's like, I'll be on a plane in the morning and I'll be there around noon. And he calls a friend of his that he used to work with in California, and he bails me out. I stay at his house that night, and he takes me to the office in the morning. My dad picks me up, walks me through this entire process, which is about a six-month process, you know, traveling back. They lived in Pennsylvania, and I was staying with them during it, you know, traveling back and forth between Pennsylvania and California about four times. And he just does everything he can to get his kid out of this jam. You know, never once did he look at me, and he said, you know, you screw up. What the hell were you thinking? You know, never once does he do that. And I'm thinking, you know, I look at my son and I think about the things he's going to do. And I'm like, I hope I can have that kind of open-mindedness and compassion for my own son. And really the reason I tell you this is because it was that time of the story. But really, to let you know the kind of people that raised me, my mom and dad are really quality people. You know, they tried to instill me with principles, but I refused at every step of the way. And I discarded them all. And I ran and I chose a life that they practically warned me against. And I got the results of that because I'm selfish and self-centered to my core. And I always think I know best. And that's still my biggest problem today. And I hate to admit that I'm wrong. And so, anyway, I'm standing in front of a judge and he says, you know, I can put you in jail for 5 years, or you can take this pile of paper and 5 years of probation. And I never considered myself the smartest guy in the room, but that was a very easy decision for me. I took the paper, probation, and one of the conditions of that was that I went back to school and I got a degree. So I went back to college. I went back to that small town in Alabama, and I got my degree. I got a degree in horticulture, not surprisingly. And for the first time in my life, I was excited about learning something because I had a direct application for everything that I was learning. And I had been a troubled student all my life, you know, learning disabled, you know, all this kind of crap. They put me in special classes and all that stuff, and because I got a little bit of dyslexia or something like that, and I have a real bad attention problem, you know. I have trouble focusing. I still do. I see it in my son, unfortunately. I guess I'm going to talk about him a lot. I'm not doing that on purpose. But So I finally have a direct application for everything I'm learning, and I start to excel in school, and professors start to notice me. And before I know it, I'm working, as an undergraduate student, I'm working in a graduate research lab with doctoral candidates and master's students, and we're doing, like, you know, studying the molecular mechanisms of plant disease resistance and, you know, all this crazy, you know, heavy-duty stuff. And, you know, I don't know how I understood it, but I did. And, you know, I was having fun with it, and the guys that I was working with were having a lot of fun. And, you know, they didn't party like undergraduates did, but they still, you know, liked to party a little bit. But they did these happy hour things, and, you know, I'd always heard about them. But for us, happy hour was like playing Mexican before we went out and went to a party so we could be plenty drunk when we went there. So we're going to these happy hours suddenly, and I find that I like them, you know. And, you know, you sit there and you drink a lot and you get drunk and you wax philosophical, and, you know, it's like, you know, I found myself very, you know, very suited for this whole intellectual endeavor of alcoholism. And at this point, you know, I really don't think I was, I drank like an alcoholic most of the time that I drank, because I think it was really at some point in this time of my life that it really started, like at some point all of a sudden a switch went off in the back of my head, and I was like, ah, that's what I've been looking for, you know. Like, I always wanted to be able to turn my brain off, and I didn't know how to do that. Because there's this gray, white noise that used to run in the back of my head, like when you're in between a radio station, it's just like going from one to the other, except there were like five or six of them. And that's the way my brain was all the time, and I just wanted to shut it off. And it was like, I don't even remember when it happened, because I would have definitely written it on my calendar if I had remembered it. But at some point along the line, alcohol started doing that for me. And that became the most important thing in the world to me. And I didn't even realize it. You know, I didn't make a conscious decision that, oh my God, I'm turning my will and my life over to alcohol today. But it happened unbeknownst to me. And suddenly my life was saturated with it. And y'all know how it is. You know, it doesn't get better from there. You know, and by the time I realized it, I had already gone off the deep end, you know. It was probably sometime around the time I discovered martinis that I mean, I knew about martinis a long time ago. I just didn't know that I could drink them, because I never really had a taste for liquor. And let's face it, that's what a martini is, right? It's like, I drank them dry. I used to tell the bartender, just let me know that a bottle of vermouth was open at somewhere in the vicinity of the martini making process. And but you look very sophisticated with those glasses, right? You know, they're cool glasses, right? That's why everybody wants to drink them, even if it's not a real martini. You know, they've got hundreds and hundreds of kind of martinis now. They probably, some of them don't even taste like a martini. But, so anyway, some people may look sophisticated holding those glasses, but I'm not one of them. And that's what I came to realize really quickly. Because the truth of the matter is that a martini is a one or two drink kind of drink. And I'm just not a one or two drink kind of guy. You know, so six or seven martinis later, I don't care who you are, you're not looking distinguished holding that glass. You're actually bumping into walls, and you're waking up the next morning with bruises on your body that you don't know how you got, you know. And it was probably like a week into the spinning bed syndrome, when I'm, you know, trying to find a wall or something to put my hand on going to bed to stop the room from spinning, that I realized that, well, you know, maybe I'm drinking too much here. And this is like 3 or 4 years down the road from that first happy hour experiment that I was just telling you about not too long ago. So I was well on my way to drinking to excess by the time I even realized I might be drinking to excess. And at this point, I'm at the end of my master's and about to start my doctorate, and, you know, suddenly a friend of mine looks at me and he tells me that he thinks I might have a drinking problem. And suddenly, I mean, probably a few years later. But so that happens, and I'm indignant, you know, because this guy's a freaking drug addict, you know. And he's telling me, that's why I hung out with him, because he made, you know, a lot of us had those, right? People that made us feel better about ourselves because he's in worse shape than me. And then here he is telling me that I got the problem and he had it all wrong. So I had to prove him wrong. So I pledged to myself that I was going to quit drinking for a period of time. I decided it was going to be 30 days. And I was going to quit drinking just to see if I could do it. You know, because an alcoholic can't do that, right? That was my understanding. And I quit for 30 days without, and I didn't have a problem. And that was probably the worst thing that could happen to a guy like me. You know, the book talks about the fact that at some point in our drinking career, we probably could have quit, but we just didn't have sufficient reason. And that's exactly what happened to me. I probably could have quit right there and walked away from it. But I didn't have, I just wanted to see if I could. But that was the last time that I was ever able to put alcohol down on my own. And that was probably, I'd guess, the summer of 2000. And so I'm like finishing up my doctorate here. I'm in the hot and heavies of my doctorate, which is pretty tough stuff for anybody that doesn't have one. There's a lot of research and a lot of writing involved in it, and I'm drinking around the clock, you know, like a 1.75 of vodka every day. And I don't know how I did it, but you know, I'd wake up in the middle of the night with cold sweats and shakes and all that kind of stuff. And it got real bad. And somehow or another, I got there and I crossed the finish line and I got my doctorate. And I remember it was December 15th, 2002. And I arranged my father as a doctorate. And my major professor and I were kind of estranged by this point. And I made arrangements for my father to hood me, you know, when they put that little silly thing over your head. And, you know, he graduated from Lehigh University in Pennsylvania. He had his hood there, and he was able to hood me. And, you know, looking back on it, it should have been like one of the greatest days of my life. I know it was one of the greatest days of my dad's life. But I'm sitting there, I'm so hungover, and I haven't had a drink for 4 hours. And I'm just sitting there stressing out and sweating. And I'm like, God damn it, I got to get out of here so I can have a drink. And when I think about that and I look back on it, even to this day, you know, I've come so far with my father, it still makes me feel really bad. So December 15th, 2002, and I'm telling myself leading up to this, you know, no major lifestyle changes until I get this degree. And then I'm going to get this drinking thing under control. And so I really start working on trying to get this drinking thing under control. And January 23rd, 2003, I go to my first rehab center because I couldn't get this drinking thing under control. And I had gone to the liquor store a few days before and I'd bought three family-sized bottles of, you know, two of Jack and one of vodka. It doesn't really matter what kind. And by the third day, I was finishing the last one, and it was in the morning. And I was like, oh my God, I got to stop doing this or I'm going to die. You know, I'm going to kill myself if I don't stop doing this and I'd have another drink in my hand. And, you know, I just remember repeating that to myself over and over throughout the day. And I, again, I'd have another drink in my hand. And I didn't know what to do. And I reached out to a friend of my dad's who had gotten sober like a year before. And I asked him for help. And he asked me if he could intercede. And I said, please. And the next thing I know, the next day I wake up and I'm in like the middle of the woods in northern Alabama. This place called Wilderness, Alabama, believe it or not. And kind of scary place. But it was an old hunting lodge that had been converted into a rehab center. And I didn't know what was going on. I was feeling like crap. And, you know, there's doing all those, you know, all those things that they do, all, you know, your intake profiles and all that kind of stuff, asking me all these crazy questions about my chemical use throughout the years and the behavior that was associated with it and all this kind of stuff. And suddenly I go and I meet my primary counselor and she's talking to me and I don't, you know, she seemed like a nice lady. And she probably was. She was probably very good at her job, too. And I have no idea to this day what she really said to me, but what I heard, you know, that alcoholic, you know, translator we have in our brain, what I heard was, you're a perfectly well-adjusted young man, and you're going to do fine. And I'm, you know, I just sit back, and I'm thinking to myself, well, give this woman a cigar, you know? She's good at her job. You know, I don't know how much they're paying you, lady, but you deserve a raise. And of course, that's not what she said to me, but that's what I heard, and that's the last thing. That's the last thing I really heard there. You know, I heard some mumbo jumbo about steps. They gave us a big book, and they made us get this sponsor thing before we could even leave. We had to have a phone number and a person that we could call and say that they were our sponsor. And so, I had a friend that was going through the same. Actually, the guy that told me I was a drunk was going through the same thing at this point, and his sponsor volunteered to be my temporary sponsor. So I get out and I'm like, you know, I can do this, you know. I know enough about this to fix this problem on my own, you know. Self-knowledge is going to cure me here. I'm a smart guy. I got a bunch of letters behind my name. I can take care of this all by myself. So I'm going to my first outpatient meeting the very night I got back, and I decided it'd be a good time to engage in an experiment and to see if I can just drink one beer. So I immediately buy a six-pack, right? That's logical, isn't it? I want to drink one beer, so I go and I buy a six-pack. That's an act of powerlessness right there. I didn't even try. And so for a little while, I'm able to control it, and then suddenly it's just off the deep end again, and it gets even worse this time. And for the next year and a half, I'm struggling with this until finally, that fall, I have a DUI and a complete and total blackout. Don't remember any of it to the day. And I come to in jail, and a cop asked me what's if I remembered what I did the night before, and I, belligerently told him that I did, and, he asked me, well, tell me, and I was like, why don't you tell me? And he did, and he tells me that I almost ran over some lady in the parking lot. I hit two parked cars, and then I proceeded to park my car in a gully right in front of my parents' house, and backed it into the gully. And that's where the cops found me. Apparently, they had to wait for me for like 5 minutes while I'm trying to. And it must have been a scene. But I was too drunk to blow, and it was ugly, And at that point, something sinks inside of us, And it's like things are breaking, and I'm losing pieces of who I am. It's like I'm just giving away pieces of my soul almost, and I feel less than I ever have felt in my entire life. And I make a promise to myself and to a God that I didn't believe in and I didn't understand. And I swore that I was going to quit drinking. I was going to do everything in my power to not drink. And I was going to go to AA. And I was going to get a sponsor. And I was going to do all these things. And I tried it all. And I went to AA. I got a sponsor. I worked some steps to the best of my ability. The only problem was that I could not stop drinking. And all these people around me are saying, put the plug in the jug. You just don't drink no matter what, If your butt falls off, put it in a wheelbarrow, take it to a meeting. And I'm like, I don't know how to do that. My bottles come with screw-on caps, first of all. They don't have plugs. And if I could keep the plug in the jug, I promise you, I wouldn't be here. I'm here. So I'm starting to delude myself into thinking that Alcoholics Anonymous isn't a place to treat people that have what I have. And I go on with this. I did my 90 meetings in 90 days. Probably should have picked up a white chip every single day, but I didn't. In fact, if I hadn't been called out for 30 or 60, I'd pick up a 30-day chip or a 60-day chip. Because I wanted you all to think that it was working for me. I like pleasing people, I guess. And I don't know why I did it, honestly. I was delusional. That's a definite. But I picked up at least one 30-day chip, and I picked up a 60-day chip, too, and I was drunk both times. And it's a bad place to be, man, It's a bad place to be in AA when you're drunk every day. It really is. And so I finally left AA because I thought there wasn't a solution for a guy like me in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. But it's amazing how even somebody of that mind that doesn't think this is going to work for me, I kept finding my way back. I'd have a really rough stretch, and I'd end up back in AA at a meeting. And I guess most of the people there, they knew I wasn't done, or they didn't know what to do with a guy like me, or a combination of the two. And they just kind of started ignoring me. And that gets bad, because then you feel like you're not even wanted in AA, which is supposed to be the last house on the block, right? It's like, damn, I'm not even welcome in AA anymore. This is bad. So, excuse me. I didn't mean to get ice in my mouth. I apologize. So, where was I? Oh, crap, I got to start over. No, I was, not welcome in AA, right? So, my life is so out of control. And in the last days of my drinking, my life just kept getting smaller. My world just kept getting smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. And it gets to a point that there's not even room for you in it anymore, or that's the way it feels. Your world's gotten so small that it's suffocating. And I remember during the summer before I got sober, I remember starting to go to bed, and I'd be thinking to myself, I'm so wasted right now, I might not wake up in the morning. And that was kind of like a fear at first, And then that turned into a hope. And then it extended into like an anger when I actually woke up and I was still alive. And I don't know if anybody's ever felt like that, but if you have, you understand that that's a really dangerous place for a person to be. You know, and it's not that long until you're going to do something to try to aid the process along. And I don't know exactly what happened in August. It was actually August 8th or 7th or 8th. And something broke inside of me. You know, I had a court officer telling me that I needed to go to rehab. I had a judge telling me to go to rehab. I was at some intensive outpatient program that was telling me I needed to go to rehab. I think my parents were probably telling me I need to go to rehab. You know, everybody around me, everybody in AA was telling me I need to go to rehab. But I had already been to rehab, and I didn't think I needed that. So I was convinced I didn't. And then, but one morning I woke up, and something broke, you know, and I'm like, I'm done. You know, I can't do this anymore. And I begged my parents. I was like, you got to help me get in somewhere. And so they told me to get on the phone and try to find someplace, and they would help me. And so I did that, and next thing I know, I'm on a plane coming down to South Florida, and I went to this detox center in Miami. Because along the way, I started having these grand mal seizure things when I'd not even stop drinking, just when I wasn't drinking enough, I'd start having these seizures. And I guess it's kind of serious, and a lot of detoxes wouldn't even talk to me about coming in because it's a dangerous, apparently alcohol is the most dangerous detox medically that there is. And my mind particularly was so bad because of how much I was drinking, I suppose, or maybe because I have a weak constitution, I don't know. But regardless, they sent me to this place in Miami, and they specialized in medical detox, and they did a really good job there, and they were great people. You know, they were all former addicts or recovered addicts, alcoholics, and they were really, really gentle people that treated you with dignity and respect, which is, you know, which means a lot when you're walking into a place like that for the first time. And, you know, so I go through this place, and I go up to this place in Fort Pierce for treatment, and things are going pretty well up there. You know, my counselor he's a great guy. I assume he's still a great guy. He was then. His name was Willie, and I sit down with him, and you know, Willie saw me coming from a mile away. And he had been a IV heroin user. I was thinking of a different way to say that, but I just don't know, you know. but he knew me, you know, and I was a drunk, you know. I was a knee crawling, bed wetting, you know, just puking all over the place, drunk. That's what I was. And any distance I've come today from that point is simply the grace of God. And Willie recognized this shattered thing inside of me, and he knew exactly what it was, and he knew exactly what the treatment for it was. And he just kind of put me off to the side, and he laughed at me a lot. And I think he enjoyed laughing at me. You know, everybody else, he was giving all this therapeutic stuff, and he was like, Bill, you need to focus on finding a relationship with God. And, you know, he was the first person that explained to me, or that I heard, I'm sure other people had done it, but he basically walked through the doctor's opinion with me, you know, just in his own words. And I walked out of the first session I had with him understanding the fact that I had this physical allergy, that once I put a drop of alcohol in my body, that something happened to me physically that created this overwhelming desire that I must have more, this need for more alcohol. And that's why I could never stop at one. And then he explained to me about this obsession of the mind that I had as well, that when I could be away from it for a certain period of time, and then my brain would trick me into thinking that it was going to be different this time. And I finally, for the first time, understood why I did things that I did. And I knew that I just wasn't completely and totally nuts. But greater than that, I understood that somebody else knew what it was like to be me. And that terminal sense of uniqueness that I walked in here with, and that kept me from getting help when I was in Auburn, Alabama, was finally gone for at least a moment. And then Willie tried to talk to me about the second step. And I told him that, you know, I was like, Willie, we got a problem here. And he's like, what's the problem, Bill? And I was like, I don't believe in God. And he just laughed. I told you, he liked to laugh at me. And, you know, he said something to the effect of, God doesn't really care what you think, Bill. And I wasn't too sure. You know, I may not believe in God, but I'm pretty sure that if he existed, he'd care what I thought. You know, pretty sure he had that one wrong. But, you know, somehow or another, he spins it out of me, and he said, you know, do you really believe that you're alone in this cosmic cycle? And, you know, I'm like, well, you know, I think maybe it's possible that, they're, you know, we're all like pieces of energy that are interconnected through, you know. And some really whacked out, you know, hippy-dippy kind of, you know, cosmos stuff. And he's like, there, you got it, man. You see. You believe that there's something bigger than you. That's all we're asking for here. And I felt like there was this amazing weight lifted off my shoulders. And I was well on my way. You know, I applied for my AA membership card that day. And, you know, but I still had this incredible, looking back on it. And I have a really good friend that always says that I live my life forward, but I understand it backwards. And that's been very true, particularly with the period of my recovery. Because I thought I was there at that moment, but I see now, looking back on it, that I still had this amazing level of arrogance and thought I knew everything and I was smarter than everyone else. The hurricanes came. That was late August 2004, and Francis came through the town, or just south of the town I was in, and just basically decimated the place, and the rehab was shut down. And I convinced them that it was a good idea for me to get on a plane and go to Alabama to get my truck and then drive back down when the rehab was back on its feet. So I was going to go to a halfway house somewhere here in Florida. And, you know, like I said, I'd already applied for my AA membership card. I was good to go. And they let me get on that plane. They probably, you know, honestly, they probably didn't care. They probably had I've always wondered how I convinced them to do that. And the truth of the matter is they probably didn't care. You know, they had enough to worry about. They let me go. And it was a great plan, and I was executing it fairly well until I got to the Atlanta airport. I was walking to baggage claim, and I noticed that there was a bar on my right, and there was $20 in my pocket. Suddenly, there was a bar stool under my butt, and there was no money in my pocket. And somewhere or another, I made it to my parents' house in Auburn, Alabama, which is about 110 miles away. And they were quite surprised to see me because I was supposed to be going to stay with friends in Atlanta. And but anyway, I went on a run that would end all my runs, or, you know, at least to this point it has, and I think if I continue to do what I'm doing, it will. It was about a 15-day run. It culminated with a bottle of whiskey and a bottle of doctor-prescribed clonopin, and I tried to take my own life, and didn't work. You guys are smart enough to tell that, aren't you? It's a sharp. But, you know, I don't know if anybody's ever tried to kill themselves here, but generally speaking, when you try to do that, your self-esteem's not very high, you know? And I'm here to tell you that when you fail, it doesn't do anything positive for your self-esteem. So I'm sitting there in this hospital, and I got tubes coming out of every orifice, and it was pretty humiliating. But I was angry more than anything that I couldn't even do this right, you know. And I don't know what my thought process was when I actually chugged the bottle and the pills, but I'm thinking it was probably something like this, because I know what I wanted more than anything else at that point, and I wanted to stop drinking. I just wanted to quit drinking. And you know how that passage in A Vision for You where Bill talks about, you know, the alcoholic at the end, and he'll get to a point that he won't be able to imagine life with alcohol or without alcohol. And that's where I was. You know, he calls it the jumping off place. They'll know loneliness like few do. And that's exactly where I was. And so I think that in my mind, what my thought process was, if I'm not here, I don't have to drink. And the only out for me at that point in my mind, this mind that I've convinced myself all the time is the best mind, is to take my own life. That's the only way I can get out of this game. And it didn't work. But anyway, I ended up getting back on the phone with that counselor in Florida the other day, and a few days from then. And he talks me into coming back down. I go back down, and I'm there, and I could tell things were different because I didn't have that level of arrogance. And I just listened, and I followed direction. And he told me I needed to go to a halfway house, so I went to a halfway house. And, you know, he told me which one we were going to, and he asked me if I wanted to know why, and I said, no, I really don't. And he said, you should probably want to know why. And I was like, okay, why? And he's like, because a guy came through here earlier, you know, that went there and he did really well. And I was like, okay, Willie, I trust you. And I just started trusting the people that were offering me help. And that was something that I had never done before in my entire life. And I went to this halfway house and, you know, I took the suggestions. As simple as they were, I took them. You know, they said, go to a meeting, you know, reach out to somebody. You know, go to a meeting your first night, go to a meeting your first morning there. And we had a house meeting the night I got there. And one of the mayors said that he opened up the, you know, the bottom line club every morning. And if you wanted to go with him, be at his car at 6:15. You know, don't be there at 6:20 because I won't. You know, so I was out there at 6:10. Waiting for him, and I went down there. You know, for the first 3 weeks I was at the halfway house, I went, and I opened up the bottom line with this guy, and I met my first sponsor there, and he was a guy that just didn't care about what anybody thought about him, and I found that incredibly attractive, you know, because all my life and I didn't even realize it, but all my life I've been terrified what other people were thinking about me, and this guy just didn't give a crap, and I was like, man, that looks so liberating, man, that looks awesome to not care what other people think. That must feel so good. And so anyway, I finally got the courage to kind of ask him to sponsor me. And he told me that if we were going to do this, we were going to do it his way and not my way. And I was like, okay, that sounds good because I don't know how to do it. And he said, you know, read the book and then call me. And I told him I was reading the book in rehab and I'm almost done. Can I finish it and then call you? He's like, yeah, that's fine. So I finish it and I call him that afternoon. And he's like, meet me at the bottom line the next morning. So I meet him at the bottom line the next morning. And we sit down and we do 1, 2, and 3. And, you know, I tried to do, you know, step one was easy for me to explain. Step two, he asked me, you know, do I believe in a power greater than myself? And I tried to give him that whole thing that I'd come up with Will. And he's like, whoa, 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 that's way too complicated. You know, give me something simple. And I just told him, I said, I believe there's a power in these rooms that's working for you guys. And I think it can work for me too. And he said, that's perfect. And we got down on our knees and we said the third step prayer. And I'll tell you, I may as well have been praying to a trash can that day. That was the level of my belief and my faith. And but he told me if I took the simple steps, great things would come of it. And I believed him. You know, one of the things that he told me would come of it is that this obsession to drink would leave me in time. And that's all I wanted. You know, all I wanted when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous was for this obsession to drink to leave me. And if somebody would have given me, you know, curtain A and curtain B, and behind curtain A is the obsession to drink will leave you. Behind curtain B is, well, you'll have to do it to find out. I would have taken curtain A, and I would have missed out on all the great stuff that comes along with, you know, with God's grace. You know, we just don't get that choice, and it's beautiful that we don't, because almost 90% of us or more would have taken it. It's just like, let me out. Get me out of this immediate pain and suffering, and I don't want any of that other joy and just awesomeness that's associated with being in the sunlight of the Spirit. So I do this third step, and he basically tells me that I'm just making a decision to go on with the rest of the steps. And he tells me at that time that this step means a lot more than that, but I don't expect you to get it right now. So I don't want you to sit here and try to figure out what this step's all about, because I've been sober for 15 years and I'm still trying to figure it out. I want you to take these actions, because these actions are going to bring you to God, and God's going to solve your problem. And I believed him. I don't know why. I really don't. I really don't know why I believed the guy, but I took a series of actions that he assured me were going to help me. They didn't make sense. I didn't understand them, and I certainly didn't believe in them, but I was desperate enough that I realized I had no other options. And so I did them. And I truly believe that, you know, my sponsor always says that, you know, gravity is a principle. And these steps are principles. You know, it doesn't matter whether you believe in them or not. They're going to apply to you. You know, if I walk up to the top of a 10-story building, it doesn't matter whether I believe in gravity or not. If I step off, I'm going to fall. Right? It's the same thing with these steps. If I take this series of actions as they're laid out in the big book with everything that I have in my heart at that moment, I'm going to come in contact with a power greater than myself. It doesn't matter what it's up to me what I do with it once I come in contact with it. But if I take these actions, I will come in contact with this power. And then I have the rest of my life to try to understand it. And I still don't understand it. Step three has come to be one of the most pivotal, you know, the most pivotal steps in this program for me. 3, 6, and 7 are just amazing steps. Where the first time I took them, I'm like, oh, they're the easiest steps in the world, you know? It's like 6 and 7, that's a no-brainer, man. How can you, you know? But wait until you got like 3 or 4 years of sobriety or any amount of time of sobriety and you run into a wall and you know, boom. It's like, oh my God, I got a character defect. I thought I was done with all them, you know? But, so anyway, I work my steps with this guy and it's grand and, you know, we did it pretty quickly. I'm a fan of that. If it works for you, I'm a fan. I think AA is very pragmatic. I think we do what works for us. If it's not working, go find somebody else that's doing something different, because certainly there are a lot of ways to do this thing and there are a lot of happy people in this room. If you're not becoming one of them doing what you're doing, go out and find somebody else that's happy and try to do what they're doing if what you're doing isn't working. You know, if you've done that several times, maybe you need to reexamine yourself because you're not really doing it. You know, maybe you're just faking it. And that only works with the God thing, the faking it till we make it. You know, actions have to be consistent and from the heart. That's my experience anyway. You know, my sponsor told me that I would find God on my feet, not on my knees. And that's been the truth. That's absolutely been my experience, you know. And I came here an atheist. And now I overwhelmingly believe that there's a power greater than myself. My faith has grown incredibly in the short time that I've been sober. You know, I met this wonderful woman that I talked about a little bit a while ago that's my wife today, and we have two beautiful children. You know, I'm a father. That's just the most amazing thing in my life. I'm an alcoholic, obviously. Is that the most important thing in my life today? I don't even know. You know, I really don't. I used to believe all that AA's got to be first, and I don't know if, you know, A's right up there, man. I got to tell you that, you know. But God is ultimately the thing that bridges all. You know, AA wouldn't work if it weren't for God. You know, AA took me to God, and I still love AA, and I still try to be as active as I possibly can. That picture has changed a lot for me in the last 3 years since I've become a father. But I still try to reach my hand out as often as I can and help another alcoholic. You know, I find myself, a little side note here. I find myself, you know, a guy that came in here as an atheist, I find myself, I'm suddenly being drawn to the Catholic Church. And, you know, I went and talked to a priest the other day, and I don't know where to go from here. You know, this is, you know, I just laid my cards on the table. I said, this is my deal. You know, I'm going to have my children baptized at the end of April. And it feels right in my heart. You know, I just feel like I'm being called to go there. That's where God wants me right now for whatever reason. I don't understand his plan, you know, and I've learned not to question it because I haven't understood it. I never would have sat there 8 years ago when I was a wreck, you know, that couldn't stop drinking and seen a glimpse of this life that he's given me today. You know, so I just have to give up and not try to wrestle control of my life and throw these little plans on the table because it's not a bargain. You know, it's like, you know, I show up and I do. And if the third step means anything to me today, it means that if I'm doing it right, my life is absolutely none of my business. And that's really what I've come to believe, is that my life isn't my business. You know, I just suit up and show up for God on a daily basis, and God gives me direction. And I try, with the best of my feeble human ability, I try to live up to that on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, this whole thing about love and God, because I really believe this. You know, Dr. Bob said it in that last reading. You guys used to read it here. You probably still do. You know, that AA comes down to love and service. And I think love is so important. And, you know, all of this, that's just God. You know, God is love. And that's what he expresses to us. And that's why all of this works. It's because we come in here and we open ourselves up to it. And God just pours this love on us. And it fixes us. You know, we take these acts of humility, and that's all the steps are as I see them. There, it's a progression of actions that humble us, and as we become humbled, it fractures that ego. And anytime our ego fractures, it creates an entrance that allows God in, and that love of God can come in. And then, you know, something happens, like I have those children, and this overwhelming sense of God just pours out of me, you know. And it's love is what I express it as, but it's God, and that's all it is. And I wouldn't be there today if I didn't have this program, and if I hadn't taken these steps. I wouldn't have that inside of me, because I'd be that selfish little prick that I walked in here as, and I'd be thinking, oh my God, my kid's crying again, I can't go out to the bar tonight, you know. And thank God I was sober when I had this life, so that I get to truly appreciate it. And it's just the ultimate blessing is, thank you, is, I thought I was done. I was like, I'll wrap it up there. the ultimate blessing is just being here, you know, showing up. And, you know, 3 years ago, I probably would have given you guys a dramatically different talk than I'm giving you tonight, because I was all about sponsorship, 12-step work. And I find today that that 10 and 11 are the strength of my program, and the latter half of 12, because I just don't have that much time to actually be in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm not always helping drunks, but I'm trying to practice these principles, and I'm trying to be of service to others, just maybe not alcoholics. And that's where I have to find my stress, because the way I see it is that if I'm being neglectful to my family so that I can be present in AA, then I'm just being that selfish guy that I always was. And I have, you know, my first responsibility has to be to my wife and my children, or else, you know, what kind of fractured reality is my son going to have and my daughter going to have if daddy's never there because he's got to go to his drunk meetings, you know? And what if he needs AA someday, or what if she needs AA someday and she's resentful of it because if that's what took daddy away from him? You know, and I just don't want to be that guy. I don't know, you know, and don't get me wrong here. I'm not trying to say this is right or wrong. This is just my experience. You know, this is the way I see the world today. And it's the path that God has laid out for me. And it's working for me thus far. You know, the obsession to drink has long been removed and it hasn't returned. So I have to take that as evidence that something I'm doing in my life is working right. And again, don't. I love AA, and I think it's, you know, I still believe that 12-step work is one of the most important things that we can do in here. But, you know, 10 and 11 are just as important. And again, that third step, you know, because if I'm not doing step 3 on a daily basis, if I'm not really turning my will and my life over to God, you know, those third step promises that come in on page 63 at the top of the page when he says, when we sincerely take such a position, all sorts of remarkable things follow. Well, what position is he talking about? The position that God's in charge of my life. And if I'm not taking that position, there's a series of promises there that don't happen for me. If I'm not in position, you know, I may as well be praying to that trash can again that I was the first time I took step 3. And then I can be doing 6 and 7, I can be doing 10 and 11, I can be doing 12 until I'm blue in the face. And it doesn't mean anything because I'm not doing it for God. I'm doing it for me. I'm doing it for my own grandeur or my own pride or some other screwed up little character defect that I have. And I'm still full of them. You know, because this disease, in my mind, in my experience, this disease is about selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. And I still suffer from all four of those things today. And I find them cropping up in my life in all sorts of preposterous ways. And they can cause all sorts of problems. You know, fortunately, my wife is incredibly understanding. And she's an alcoholic, too. So she sees it oftentimes before I do. And she can just pull me aside sometimes and she says, you know, honey, I think you need to pray. Or call your sponsor. And it really makes me mad when she does. And oftentimes I'll just out of spite, I won't do it for a couple hours. I'm going to show her. I'm going to sit in my shit. Mm-hmm. And then, but, you know, ultimately it doesn't change much, you know. What we have to do in Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't change much. It just gets better as God keeps heaping. He keeps heaping these things on us. You know, I see a lot of people here that I've known since we first came over to Tampa in December of 2007. Yeah, you know, so that was kind of a long time ago. And I see a lot of people that are still here. I don't know, there are a lot of people I don't see anymore. I hope they're just out on Valentine dates or have moved and are doing great things in Alcoholics Anonymous elsewhere. Because, or maybe they have families like I do and they just can't get out every night of the week anymore. But anyway, I don't know what else to say. And it's been a pleasure seeing y'all, and it's been a pleasure speaking to you. I hope what I said made some kind of sense to you, and I just wasn't like this rambling maniac up here. Or maybe I was a rambling maniac up here, but some of the stuff I said made enough sense that you at least enjoyed listening to me. So thanks a lot.